It's the Stomping Tom edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, goodbye Stomping Tom, fun drive results, censoring the anti-vaxxers, and atheist church. Let's begin episode 202.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross sword for politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of star stuff. We are aware of the cosmos and know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others, and we've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello out there, we're on the air, it's hockey night tonight. Tension grows, the whistle blows, and the puck goes down the ice. The goalie jumps and the players bump and the fans all go insane. Someone roars, Bobby scores at the good old hockey game. Oh, the good old hockey game is the best game.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. And my name is Ethan, your freethinking historian.
And this is Don, your skeptical philosopher, political scientist. So, Ethan?
Yes.
Sad week.
Yeah, we lost good old Stompin' Tom.
Yeah. As our listeners may know, CITR is primarily a music station, and our show has little to do with music most times. However, occasionally, the path between talk and music radio will cross. So, again, like I said, I'd like to take a moment to sort of say goodbye to a great Canadian icon. Now, as they say, most people have heard, Stompin' Tom died last week. Stompin' Tom has always been very proud of his Canadian identity, which could be heard in his songs about this country. You know, Canada Day, Up Canada Way, the hockey song, Bud the Spud, Sudbury Saturday Nights, and many more. If it was not about Canada, his songs were almost always placed in Canada or about Canadians. He should be seen as sort of the premier poet laureate of Canada. He said in an interview in 2008, when he was like 72 years old, "I don't know why I seem to be the only one, or almost the only one, writing about this country. It just amazes me that I've been going on so long. I would think that somebody else would have picked up the torch a long time ago and started writing tons of songs about this country. This country is the most underwritten country in the world as far as songs are concerned. We're starved. The people of this country are starved for songs about their homeland." He lived and worked in Canada and was offended by what he called border jumpers, those people who were awarded Canadian awards but who were based and worked outside of Canada. Think of things like William Shatner and Dossier and Dale and that sort of thing. In 1976, he famously returned all his Juno awards in a protest stating, "I feel the Junos should be for people who live in Canada, whose main base of business operation is in Canada, who are working towards the recognition of Canadian talent in this country, who are trying to further the exports of such talent from this country to the world with a view of proudly showing off that this country can contribute to the world market." Although famous by Canadian standards, he never lost his sort of oneness for his fellow Canadian. He was often known to, after a show, talk to fans, especially if you'd buy him a beer. He would make sure that anyone who wanted an autograph got one. He came from real people, he was one of them, and he never forgot that. Connor said in an interview in 2008, "I do it for my country. I do it for my countrymen. That's the only value I really have. If there was no money in this, I'd be doing it anyway. I've always been that way because that's what I am." It's a truly sad week for Canadians everywhere. So long, Stompin' Tom. You will be missed, but not forgotten.
Yes. Probably not quite of my generation of songwriter.
No, well, it's ironic that when he did his big protest towards the end of the 70s, he actually kind of removed himself from the public limelight. He was essentially, I guess disgusted would be the best word, at all of the accolades that were going to what he considered to be sort of traitors to the Canadian identity. And now, granted, hyper-nationalism has its own issues, but he was definitely willing to say there is such a thing as Canadian culture and it needs and deserves to be not protected so much, but
perhaps honored.
honored and encouraged and celebrated and all that. And we were talking about before the show that people of different generations will notice that in the early 80s when cable TV started becoming a prominent thing, later in the 90s when you had satellite TV, that there was a really sort of distinctive Canadian culture. I mean, you'd still sort of, you know, say we define ourselves as not American, but there was still very much Canadianism in Canada. But with the inundation of American TV, that's pretty much diminished quite a bit and diminishing continually. Maybe it's a new form of globalism, who knows? But people of his generation, people like I remember, that sort of thing, is you could see what he was saying, is that, you know, we should be proud of Canada because we are unique and distinct.
Mm.
Maybe not so much anymore.
But he did sort of point to an issue with Canada, particularly with our entertainment industry, is that we don't really have one. A lot of our best talent, not because they're traitors, because they need to go to America to get the recognition they want for their talents. Like, I mean, you look at William Shatner, for instance, right? I mean, would he have ever achieved his level of fame had he not gone to Hollywood and done Star Trek and such? Could he have done that in Canada?
Well, I mean, you have other actors like Donald Sutherland, who in the end kind of betrayed us in the sense for tax reasons. But I mean, he pretty much stayed focused in Canada as his landmark for a long time. And like I say, it's, if you think back in the 70s, I mean, there were a lot of great Canadian groups that were still very much Canadian. And he didn't have a problem with going to the States and making a lot of money. I mean, let's think of something like the Bare Naked Ladies, which I still think are a quintessential Canadian band, even though they made their money in the States. But they didn't move to the States. They didn't become American. They stayed Canadian and profited off the American system. And that's where I think he had the issue. It was like someone like William Shatner, although he's quirkily Canadian, he's an American. I mean, he sees himself as American now. He has American citizenship. He's, you know, and I mean, I don't condemn him for that, right? If you need to do that, you need to do that. But part of what he was saying is that instead of us trying to grasp to the coattails of someone like that and saying, look, we're kind of important too because there's someone who happened to be born in Canada and is famous, where we should be looking at our internal talent and saying, hey, we need to nurture these people. Because if we don't nurture them, then we're really forcing them to go to the States to get that. Because one of the big things that's also happened in the last 30 or 40 years is you have things like the National Film Board, the CBC, a lot of local television has been defunded by the federal government, provincial governments, local governments. So there isn't the money to pour into these sort of things. And you become more and more dependent on the teat of American commercialism.
Yeah, it's sort of an unfortunate reality of the times. But I mean, we sort of are on the topic of Canadian talent and Canadian entertainment. We at CITR just had our fun drive, and speaking of Canadian talent, we are Canadian talent.
We are.
So how did we do, Don, for our fun drive?
We did actually quite good. I'm quite happy and proud. Thank you, everyone. We got a little over 80% of our total. We were aiming for $600, didn't quite get there, got about $500, but very, very good. I'd like to give a shout-out to Merlene Clow, Louis Bazant, Harold McLennigan, Ian Bushfield, Julie Clausen, and Heather. You know who you are, Heather, who donated via the phone line. And those people who donated online.
Well, we have a couple anonymous donors. So maybe it was people from Anonymous. Maybe they like our show.
Yeah, hey.
That'd be pretty cool. And Peter also donated online. So, you know, we really appreciate everyone who donated online. David, for example, also helped us out online. Your donations make a big difference, not only for us here on the show, but for this station, which, as Don and I have just been discussing, does have a pretty good role here for fostering Canadian talent and putting out a good skeptical message on the radio. And I guess getting onto that skeptical message, Don, there's much to talk about.
Yes. Okay. So some people were listening to our live show. Well, I guess they're always live show, but our out of studio recording last week about, we were talking about the anti-vaxxers. Now, I've had some pretty lively discussion about my push to censor the anti-vax movement because of the health dangers they pose to the community. I've equated them to sort of yelling fire in a crowded theater, but perhaps that was not the best analogy I could use. First, when I say directly responsible, some may confuse this with proximal or immediate cause. I'm not saying that the speakers at the conference are going out and killing babies with their hands. That's why the sort of the fire analogy was perhaps a poor choice on my part. But I still claim, at least for some, a direct causal link from their talk to the deaths of children. I think a better analogy is hate speech. Perhaps comparing them to Holocaust deniers would be, if not equivalent in magnitude, similar in form. So hate speech works on the principle, if a person says something that is demonstrably false, which actually or is likely to inspire others to act, that causes a vulnerable group to suffer. Do they fit this bill? Kind of yes and no. More yes, I think, than no. But let's go into this. These speakers are talking to a group of people who will, by not getting their children vaccinated, directly result in the suffering and possible deaths of their children and others at-risk members of the community. I think there is a direct link here, but what they're saying demonstrably false? So let's look at that idea. First, the idea they truly believe it is not really a defense. I suspect many racists have a firm and honest belief in the inferiority of other races, so I don't think ignorance is a defense in this case. Now, is what they're saying demonstrably false, to the point that any reasonable person would know so? And I accept that the onus on this part is on me, and it is a pretty high bar to reach, but I think I do achieve it. So to answer this question, I checked out their website and what they're going to be talking about. So some of the topics include vaccines cause autism, heavy metal poisoning comes from vaccines, vaccines are unphysiological, disease, at least the measles, is a good thing for building your immune system, and aluminum builds up in the body causing brain damage. So willful ignorance causing suffering and death. The claim that vaccines cause autism has been researched extensively by groups in both, quote, the big pharma camp and those out of it. So people who have no vested interest in trying to promote some sort of global conspiracy. There's been statistical analysis that shows there's no link to connect autism with vaccines. Every mechanism claimed by the anti-vax movement has been debunked. This is a lie, and they know it's a lie, or at least they should know it's a lie. Now, heavy metal poisoning from vaccines. Well, you can get heavy metal poisoning if you have a sufficient amount of heavy metal. And the only heavy metal that I seem to be able to track down that they're referring to here is aluminum, which is used as an anti-vagilant.
Adjuvant?
Adjuvant. Now, again, we have to be careful here. We're not actually talking about aluminum. We're talking about aluminum hydroxide. Think of the difference between rust and steel. There is no evidence that this is actually toxic in the bloodstream, and there's very controversial evidence that if you applied it directly to the brain cells, there may be an effect. But one could say that if you applied salt directly to the brain cell, it would have some effect as well.
Right.
The other aspect is that if the aluminum builds up in your system, so if you get a buildup of aluminum body, at some point it can become toxic and lead to other complications. There are some now considered to be dubious studies that showed a link between aluminum buildup and Alzheimer's disease, but now this is considered to be a false flag sort of situation. But that said, the amount of aluminum required for this to be a factor is a magnitude of magnitudes order greater than what's found in the vaccinations of children. So again, you know, even if you said that this could happen, there's nowhere near enough for it to happen. And this is well known. This is not like something. So again, willfully false. They also try to discredit vaccines with articles that promote, quote, the whole basis of vaccination is unphysiological. The vast majority of infections enter through the nasal cavity and the gastrointestinal tract. Trying to make the case that it's not even targeting sort of the right areas to sort of elicit a good immune response. And further, that by directing the vaccination directly into the muscle, you're, quote, poisoning the brain with aluminum and actually giving the disease to the child by, quote, circumventing 80% of the body's immune system.
Their misunderstanding of how the body works is boggling.
Well, you know, that's the thing, because this one article, and I must admit, you know, this is one of
those. That's not even a little wrong. That's like a lot wrong.
Well, there was so much gish galloping, you know, plopping down of disconnected ideas and plunking down of facts that are actually circular in reference and all that, and just outright things that we now know are not true, that it was more like paranoid ranting.
You right. Almost expect to hear them talk about the four humors, but that even that seems too intelligent for their rhetoric.
And again, you know, this is an important thing. It's willful, or at least it's dangerously delusional, right? There's a bar to hear. And if they were just ranting about how the Twin Towers was part of some conspiracy, okay, you're an insane conspiracy nut, maybe, but there's no real harm in propagating that idea. But there's a direct link.
Yeah, Don, a good quote that I recall, and I think I've mentioned this before, and it comes from Dr. Stephen Novella, who said that at a certain point, whether you're being dishonest or whether you're just spreading demonstrably false misinformation, that line just blurs at a certain point, and it no longer matters. It no longer matters whether or not you honestly believe this is true or whether or not you're just lying to get something, because you're doing the same amount of harm.
Well, you know, just to give you an idea of how far this group is, and now I'm gonna be this is directed exactly at the Vaccination Awareness Network, right? So it's at this particular group, and I don't want to tar and feather that every anti-vax group is necessarily as way out there as there, but this one jumped the shark. On their website, they have an article that propagates the conspiracy that AIDS was created and distributed by the World Health Organization as some sort of UN plot. They have they comment or quote research into the H1N vaccine. Well, let me just read you the quote and you'll see. So documents implicating the CDC, the WHO, numerous vaccine manufacturers, along with government agencies, in collusion with the Rockefeller Trust, Rupert Murdoch, and other media, real estate, and medical industrial moguls, in a genocidal plot to use vaccines, in particular the H1N1 flu vaccine, as a bioweapon to deliberately sicken and depopulate the planet. It boggles the mind that you're allowed to say this sort of stuff in this venue. You know, that it's just it transcends that. And of course, it's ironic because they're actually ignoring some real issues. I mean, if they had come out and, you know, there's a possible link between the H1N vaccine and people who have a genetic disposition to narcolepsy. We've covered that on the show, right? It's not a big thing, but I mean, hey, at least it's something you sort of have a reality to base it on. There's the idea, you know, do mandatory flu vaccines that are only usually about 60 to 70% effective. Should we have that? Okay, I don't agree with it, but I mean, there's at least a real debate to be had there. Even the idea of doing clinical trials and vaccines and methods as to see which is the best to work. I mean, at present, we can't really do that because it's considered unethical to deny a patient the best possible treatment.
Right, exactly.
So to me, this is equivalent to a hate group that is caught that's causing real harm and deaths. There is no sense of responsibility, and they are willfully propagating falsehoods and lies. They at least, in this particular group at least, should be banned from public speech, or at least vilified by society, most notably in the case of SFU. If this was Ernst Zundel, I doubt SFU would allow his free speech, and they wouldn't hide behind the idea of free speech as a defense. Free speech should only be denied in very rare and extreme cases. So, I mean, I'm not saying that this is not a black and white, you know, hey, we should do it. But I think, yes, this is one of the cases where it should it's crossed the boundary.
Well, you know, I'll sort of separate myself from some of the opinions of, like, CFI and others that I represent, because I know that there are different points of view on how far should we go in our tolerance of free speech. And I think that's a valid argument to have. But I want to recap my personal opinion that this is not a free speech issue. I personally think that SFU basically got this broom booking and went, are they going to pay the fee? Yes. Are they going to bring in outside food? No. Okay. Stamp approved. I can't prove that, and I may be casting unfair remarks about people, and I apologize if that's the case. But SFU is responding to this like they're saying, well, we're going to let this debate air out. But it's not a debate. They're not sending representatives. They're not presenting a science point of view. They're just letting these people talk about medical lies.
It's not even a science point of view. It's a rational point of view.
Yeah.
I mean, they are saying that gravity does not exist. I mean, they are some of the things they are saying are that far out there.
And I think that the idea that this is a free speech issue also should make us wonder, well, then is it also a free speech issue when Health Canada says, no, you can't write that homeopathy cures cancer on a piece of medicine? Because that's exactly what they do. They say you cannot lie about medicine in advertising or in the media. So why is it that you can go to a university, lie about vaccines, potentially endanger the people who go there, turn them into walking biohazards, as it were, and say, well, it's free speech? But you're talking about a science issue. Science is not a democracy, as much as we maybe would hope it would be. It is about the consensus of evidence. It is about a rational inquiry into evidence independent of our opinions. And the vaccine issue, particularly the claims they're making, have long been debunked. It's not like they're talking about legitimate questions. I mean, you mentioned there are legitimate concerns with vaccines and that they should, of course, be looking at. But these, this is mind-boggling conspiracy theories that are not only endangering the people who listen to it, it's endangering everybody who may get whooping cough or something if her immunity falls any lower.
Well, and let's not forget, they have one person at least at this conference who's presenting the idea, at least from her writings and from what I can gather from their propaganda, that we should infect kids with these diseases that killed people in the past because it strengthens their immune system. And actually, you know, if they eat healthy and if they're like good children to begin with, they won't even get these diseases in the first place. And that's so wrong. I mean, one of the problems we have is that vaccines have been so effective, we don't really understand the harm we're doing by allowing them to sort of fade away to a certain degree.
They're victims of their own success.
Yeah. I mean, thousands of people died because we didn't have these vaccines.
Yeah.
You know, and it's criminal. I mean, it is not borderline criminal. It's criminal in my mind. Again, there are shades of gray in this debate. These people, not the shade of gray. They're at the black. This is cut and dry. This is, you know,
this is about as clear cut as cases you could make for speech causing harm.
And then you have to go with the other. There's sort of the second idea, because we talked about free speech many times before. And so there's the legal case of free speech, right? But then there's also the social aspect of free speech. And this is where I think you have the most issue with SFU, is that SFU is an academic institution. By allowing this to happen there, there is a certain amount of acceptability, a certain amount of this might actually be plausible, that
tacit approval,
that goes on with this. And where SFU, even if they said, listen, legally, we can't deny them, but we denounce what they have to say. I mean, that would have been a perfectly acceptable thing for them to
say. Yeah, say, our hands are tied. We have to rent the space to them, but we're going to hold a pro-science conference the next day and invite our entire Faculty of Health and Sciences, who, for their right, have been outstanding in their support of science. The letter they issued was incredibly strongly worded. I thought it was very good. I think that there's a lot of – I think – you know, the administration should be as embarrassed and horrified as the science departments have been at SFU.
And they should review their procedures for accepting this. When is this conference happening again?
It's today.
It's today?
Yeah, it's actually starting in about like a couple minutes.
So, Ethan, have you got your minions to go out there and storm the Palisades? And is there going to be like book burning or something going on?
Yeah, no, the book burning idea didn't really make it off the ground. No, actually, I'm glad you mentioned this, because I did post something to the CFI's Facebook page about this. In the past, we have done things where we've like flyered or handed out information.
Skepticism.
Yeah, at various activities. Over the years, though, we've kind of learned what makes these efforts effective and what makes them sort of waste of time. And this, unfortunately, would be a waste of time, because the layout of SFU is not to our benefit. They're right next to the security office. It's inside private property. And if they kicked us out, we'd be banished to the sidewalk, which is really far away from the entrance. So it's like we would just be standing there in the rain, you know, talking to ourselves while people walked around us. Wouldn't really serve any purpose. The other downside is that the anti-vax community is particularly hostile to criticism. And I don't want to say that every person who doubts vaccines is going to punch you in the face, but the few times that I actually have interacted with anti-vaxxers have been aggressive conversations. I've been accused of being in the pocket of Big Pharma. I had someone like yell at me, who sent you? I was like, I came on my own, buddy. Like, But I mean, there's a lot of potential risk for, I think, really heated arguments that will go nowhere and ultimately, I think, just enrage and cause problems.
And a lot of non sequiturs. I mean, you were talking about before the show about how one of the anti-vaxxers claims to have some sort of credentials for talking about this, and his credentials were he can read and write. I mean, you did it much more excitingly than that, but it's like, what was it? I'm a medical journalist. So what are your credentials? I'm a medical journalist. I'm a medical journalist. So you can read and you can write. That's your qualifications.
Yeah.
So I have one other question, Ethan, for you. And I know we're going to push a break back a little bit here, but I think this is important. Maybe we'll cover it later more intensively. You've been really busy with the press. There's been a lot of press coverage about this. One could make the argument this event would have happened and disappeared and three people would have shown up. But the fact that you have made it, or this thing has made it such a big thing that they've got so much free press that it's going to be so much bigger than it would have been if you just sort of ignored it. Well, what do you say about that?
Well, I think that it's true. We could have just ignored it and hoped it would have passed quietly. But as you mentioned, this is not simply a question of some people saying crazy things. This is a public health risk. And the media, for whatever reason, has in the past been on the side of the anti-vaxxers. They give a platform for people like Jenny McCarthy and Oprah to go out there and say things. We need the media to be more aware of the potential dangers of this. And I think that I've at least been optimistic, and I've had nice conversations with some of the reporters and people that I've talked to have shown to me that the media is catching on, that this is a important issue that they need to shine a light on. They may not like talking to anti-vaxxers and they may not like giving them free publicity, but people need to know what they're saying, and they need to know that the scientific community is not in a state of controversy about this. They have examine the evidence, we know what's going on, and these anti-vaxxers are just spreading misinformation, dangerous misinformation.
But you were telling me, I think before, that actually it gets a bit more complicated because the media sources themselves, I mean, some of them are sort of agnostic and need to be educated, but some of them have their own biases as well. And I think you were mentioning to me about a cameraman who definitely was on the side of the anti-vaxxers.
Yeah, that was the one strange experience I had. I did one interview with a certain media outlet, and it was kind of strange. They sort of, I guess, kept asking me sort of the same question over and over again, I guess trying to get me to say something different, but I wasn't going to. And then after the interview, we had like a 15-minute conversation where they were asking me about, well, what about the flu shot? It doesn't even work half the time. And I'm like, well, that's not really accurate, and I'm trying to explain the science behind vaccinations, and of course I'm not a scientist, so I'm not doing a very good job, but I mean the vibe that I got from them was actually quite hostile, and at the end they basically just said, well, I disagree. I'm like, okay, I mean, that's, you're certainly allowed to do that, but I mean, it is kind of frustrating. But that's been the exception. By and large, the majority of the interactions I've had have been very positive, and I'm quite optimistic about that.
You know, if only there was some sort of, I don't know, source of supreme power that we could refer to. You know, like they're electing the Pope in the Vatican City, right? And I mean, if we had a Pope, and if he overrode something like, I don't know, an atheist church, maybe then we could have some sort of a power to push our points. When we come back from this break, we're going to talk about the atheist church.
In the sky, standing on a planet. Really, I'm just a speck compared with a star.
Radio Free Thinker is broadcast Tuesdays at 3:30 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. You can also hear us Mondays at 8 a.m. on UMFM 101.5 FM in Winnipeg, Fridays at 3 p.m. on CFBX 92.5 FM in Kamloops, and Saturdays at 9 a.m. on CKXU 88.3 FM in Lethbridge. Our thanks to all the stations that broadcast Radio Free Thinker and help promote skepticism and critical thinking. If you would like to have Radio Free Thinker syndicated on your local station, please email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
We've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Are you looking for a volunteer opportunity that fits your schedule? Being a big sister takes less time than you think, and you can choose the volunteer opportunity that fits your life. Spend just 1 hour a week as a study buddy, tutor, or 2 hours a week as a big sister. Check out the various mentoring programs at Big Sisters of BC Lower Mainland and find a volunteer position and a little sister that will suit you to a T. Visit bigsisters.bc.ca for more information today.
This is Phil Plait of badastronomy.com, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM for UBC in Vancouver, British Columbia.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. So, Don,
I was alluding to something.
You were alluding.
Subtly.
Yes.
There's been a movement lately to establish churches for the atheist community. No, these are not attempts by the Christian church to go out and convert atheists, but atheists themselves, and mainly apostates, who miss the community that comes with sort of the Christian life. A pair of well-meaning comedians set up the first British atheist church in an old Anglican church in London, and there are plans afoot to set up other churches in other cities across the aisle. At the UK branch, there's things like singing, you know, the Stevie Wonder, Queen, that
makes
sort of
sense.
Thing.
Yep.
There are lectures on topics like the origin of antimatter, public readings from works like Alice in Wonderland, and other communal activities. Although officially called the Sunday Service, the title Atheist Church is sort of stuck, and it seems to be welcomed by the gatherers. There is a Calgary Secular Church, which meets in a theater once a month, which, to quote, allows like-minded people the chance to get together, to fellowship, to share stories, to enjoy beautiful music, to have their children get excellent ethical and rational instruction, to be enlightened, and most importantly, to know they are not alone. Now, there are a number of interesting things about this movement. A lot of those who are members emphasize the community aspect of it. To quote one of the, quote, parishioners, if I can use that term, I think people need that sense of connectedness because everyone is so singular right now. And to be part of something, to feel like you are a part of something, that what people are craving, it's what people are craving in the world. Now, of course, I have some issues with this. First, the term church is explicitly a Christian term from the Greek meaning belonging to the Lord. And they don't mean, you know, the Lord of Downton Abbey kind of thing. They mean Jesus Christ type Lord. A better term might be congregational. You know, I know there are some religious groups out there who actually use the term congregational, but the actual root of the word just means gathering of people, which I think seems to be sort of the whole point of the movement. Now, the term religion is perhaps worse, not in its definition, but in its sort of long-term implications. Religion is defined as a particular system of faith and worship. But as a skeptical or a scientific atheist, you would never adhere to a system of faith. Faith, of course, is believing in something without evidence, and that's something we tend to frown upon in our community. The idea of worshiping anyone would strike at least the skeptics as sort of anathema. There is an aspect to this concept of worship that implies sort of blind following, always being right, sort of a surrendering of will. The irony is that such churches, at least as communal support groups, already exist around the world. There are the skeptics in the pub phenomena, and not all of them are in pubs, which just goes to show you that this idea that has stretched from its original form, that the and it's in a process of transforming from sort of being a drinking club to more of a secular community center. Another worry I have about the atheist church is that its members are not necessarily atheist, but, quote, no religion. That is, they sort of believe in a higher power or some form of spiritualism that's not really founded in reality. Why this becomes troublesome is that some of these types are actually pushing to make the church more as a real religion in the sort of traditional sense. One parishioner said that it will become an organized religion. It's inevitable. A belief system will set in. There will be a structure and ethical outlook on life, which just shows you sort of the signs of demagogue, you know, the dem-dare atheist in the atheist pews. You know, I mean, the idea that, you know, once you start saying this is the rules, period, you become dogmatic, which, again, is not something that we tend to adhere to. There are a number of sort of Ten Commandments that are popping up from atheist groups. I have a few sets to go through here, so you may want to grab a drink while you have a moment. This set is part of the UK Atheist Church. It's done by a writer named Alain de Botton in his Atheist Manifesto. So, one, resilience. Keep going even when things are looking dark. Empathy, the capacity to connect imaginatively with the suffering and unique experiences of another person. Patience, we should grow calmer and more forgiving by getting more realistic about how things actually tend to go on. Sacrifice, we won't ever manage to raise a family, love someone else, or save the planet if we don't keep up with the art of self-sacrifice. Politeness. Politeness is very linked to tolerance, the capacity to live alongside people who will never agree with, but at the same time you can't avoid. Humor. Like anger, humor springs from disappointment, but it's disappointment optimally channeled. Self-awareness. To know oneself is to try not to blame others for one's troubles and moods. To have a sense of what's going on the outside, on the inside of oneself, and what actually belongs to the world. Forgiveness. It's that recognition that living with others isn't possible without causing errors. Hope. Pessimism isn't necessarily deep, nor optimism shallow. Confidence. Confidence isn't arrogance. It's based on the constant awareness of how life is and how little we ultimately lose from risking everything. Now, not to be left out, the Calgary Secular Church has their own set of commandments, which were taken from the activist writer Adam Lee. First commandment. Do not do to others what you would want them to do to you.
Not want them to do to you.
Thank you. Which, I mean, is a pretty classic one.
I think they stole that commandment from another source.
Yes, you know. It,
plagiarists. It's,
in all things, strive to cause no harm. Aristotle. Treat your fellow human beings, your fellow living things, and the world in general with love, honesty, faithfulness, and respect. Kind of Kantian. Do not overlook evil or shrink from administering justice, but always be ready to forgive wrongdoers freely admitted and honestly regretted. Live life with a sense of joy and wonder. Always seek to be learning something new. Test all things. Always check your ideas against the facts and be ready to discard even a cherished belief if it does not conform to them. Never seek to...
Sorry, I'm not laughing. Never mind. Go ahead. I just had a funny thought.
Never interrupt the Don when he's talking.
Sorry.
No, I made that one up. Never seek to censor or cut yourself off from dissidents. Always respect the right of others to disagree with you. Form independent opinions on the basis of your own reason and experience. Do not allow yourself to be led blindly by others. And the 10th commandment. Drum roll, please. Question everything.
Okay, so what I was going to say is that what they should do is take the 7th commandment, make that the first one, and then just have a line through all the other commandments.
Yeah, no, it's... first of all, the idea of commandments, again, implies a certain unchangingness. Although, I guess you're right, the 7th actually is the rule that is the exception to itself.
Well, I mean, like, some of these contradict themselves. Like, the 4th one says, do not overlook evil or shrink from administering justice. And the 5th one says, live life with a sense of joy and wonder. I'm not really sure how you can do both of those things.
Yes.
I mean, I don't know too many, like, UN human rights advocates go through life happy and content.
Well, you get the sense, too, that the second set were done by a committee. Because they got the first few ideas. Yeah, okay, we all agree with that. And then they start getting much wordier, right? But Ethan, what do you think of the whole idea of an atheist church? And I'm emphasis on the word atheist church.
Right, as opposed to atheist church.
Well, as opposed to skeptics in the pub. Even the Calgary one is what? The secular...
The Calgary Secular Church, isn't it?
Is it church?
Well, I mean, regardless of what they call themselves, it is, I think it would be hypocritical of me to say things like, I disapprove of this particular form of skepticism, since I'm always saying that you should not go out of your way to criticize other skeptics and other atheists for doing their skepticism and atheism. I think that we've had way too much of that in the past, of people going, no, you're doing it wrong, do it my way, because I have the right way of doing it, being a skeptic. And I think that that's counterproductive. Personally, this is not my method of doing things. But I can understand for someone who is a formerly religious person, you know, particularly maybe a Christian, wanting to replace sort of the ritual and the community bonding that went with church that may not necessarily be filled in by going to a Skeptics in the Pub or even, say, being a member of, like, CFI or something like that. And I think that there have actually been some interesting, you know, research into why, for instance, is the free thought movement not overflowing with people? Because you think that we would actually, even though it's a, we have low demographics to begin with, we should have more members than we do. You know, that we're doing something that's not attracting people that are non-religious. And one of the ideas that's been pop up, especially from the like Harvard humanist sort of collective, is that part of the attraction of a church is that they have these rituals, this level of worship, this sort of community bonding that makes people feel like they belong. And that the modern free thought movement doesn't really do that. In fact, if anything, we kind of push against that. We sort of resist ritual to a certain extent. We resist the ideas of community to a certain extent. I mean, how many times have you heard some, like an atheist or a skeptic, think that, you know, I don't need to listen to the group. I'm an individual. I know what's best for me, and I'm not going to get sucked into this groupthink thing going on. I think that actually is a real phenomenon. So I can understand why they want to go with a secular church. Again, not my particular way of doing things, but I can understand it.
I understand what you're saying. I mean, one of the things, because, you know, skeptics or atheists, and again, more skeptics than perhaps the atheists, because you can have people like the Bill Maher's who are, you know, they don't believe in God, but they don't really follow into this question everything and follow the evidence where it leads. But, I mean, one, I wouldn't criticize the skeptic or atheist community for not being as good at building a community as, let's say, the Catholic Church, which, to be fair, has had 2,000 years to practice. Give us that long. But one of the things that worry me, especially, like I say, when you use the word ritual and all that, right, those can always be, they become dogmatic and they become entrenched. And again, maybe it's just the nature of the community, but there's always going to be sort of a natural pushback against that sort of thing. I mean,
well, I wouldn't say necessarily it becomes dogmatic, but it becomes psychological. Like, I think that part of the attraction to any kind of group, whether it's a church or even something as simple as like a club, is you form sort of psychological bonds with not just the people in the club, but the club's way of doing things. So you get almost like an attachment to whether it's a menorah or the what is that thing where they eat crackers and drink wine?
Well, no, I mean, you can even go so far as a kilt and haggis, because I think that's another way you can go with this. Because what we're really dealing with here isn't so much an atheist community, but it's the trouble that any minority feels in a majority thing. I mean, atheists still are a minority in the world. Sorry,
of course, yeah.
And as such, you know, to find each other becomes sort of difficult. Now, we do have what seems to be so far traditionally natural points, is again your religion. So we have churches, we have ethnic community centers. You know, you can go to the Filipino community center, the Vietnamese community center, where you can meet sort of like-minded people and commune with them. And the skeptic community hasn't really done a lot in that line, because there isn't really a model to follow on. I mean, I give them credit. They are saying, well, the churches do it this way, and we're going to follow this way. We were talking about before the show that the Skeptics in the Pub is sort of following on the Enlightenment tradition of the coffee house, you know, where people would get together and they would promote that sort of idea. And I think that's very good and valid. But it does miss... One of the things that was interesting about the Calgary Secular Church was the emphasis on the idea of Sunday school, about passing on this ethic and ethos of skepticism onto the next generation. And that's something that I think pretty much absent from almost any skeptical entity that I can. It's almost exclusively directed to the adults only, with the rare, you know, bone for, hey, let's have a little kid's version of the adult thing.
Yeah.
But not like the Sunday school. And to be fair, that's one of the things the church has learned very well. If you get a kid by 8 years old, you've got him for life. You know, once you've learned critical thinking, it's hard to unlearn it.
Well, that was... There's something that reminds me that Carl Sagan once said about every child is a scientist, but we beat it out of them by the age of like 10 or something. And I think that, you know, the skeptic community, the free thought movement is still young, right? And I think we're still learning how to build communities. I think that there are promising things that are happening, like Camp Quest in America is like a summer camp for young skeptics to go to, learn about nature and science. And I think that Skeptic Camp is also a good example. This past Skeptic Camp here in Vancouver, we had a kids track where they could go and like play Legos and learn a little bit about science. They went to the Biodiversity Museum. So we're learning. We're not quite at the point where we can say we are serving all segments of our demographic, because we're not, obviously. And I don't know. Like, I mean, that's the thing. Like, I'm not going to say that they're doing it wrong, these atheist churches, because it's not a bad idea for someone if this is what you want. It's sort of like the Unitarian Church in many ways, except I guess that's more if you were to have like a graph with atheists on one far side and Christian on one far, or I guess religious on one far side, the atheist church is sort of, you know, just sort of left of that dividing line, and the Unitarians are just sort of right of that dividing line. But it's kind of filling that same role.
Yeah, sort of the people who we kind of believe in God, but that's really about as far as we want to go down that road.
Yeah, and this could be like a stepping stone for someone to, you know, if you were even a moderately religious person and your family was religious and you decide, you know, I'm an atheist now, you may need sort of guidance and help to get yourself to a point where you're ready to consider yourself either an activist or even just identifying as an atheist per se. You may need to sort of go down that path. You know, start with the Unitarian Church, move on to the atheist church, and then one day you start calling yourself a skeptic.
See, maybe the way you put it, because that's one of the things that I have an issue with, is that I think, sorry, the Scotchmen out there in the world, but I think to be a true atheist, you must first sort of be a skeptic. I mean, it's the skepticism that allows you to say, okay, there is no God. It kind of, you know, I can assert there is no God, but I'm doing it really on the same foundations that the Pope is saying there is a God.
Mm-hmm.
And to sit there and say that atheism is a religion is kind of like, and I'm stealing this from the web, this is kind of like saying not playing soccer is a sport.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. You know? No, I agree entirely with that point. And I think that there's a slight difference between atheism, which is purely lack of belief of gods or gods, and humanism, which is a moral ethic system that can be secular, doesn't have to be, but can be, and is commonly associated with atheists. I mean, and like 90% of atheists are probably also humanists, whether they want to admit it or not. So you could say that that collection of ethical guidelines that you find in humanism fills the gap of the religious stuff in religion. But that's also, I think, a separate debate. I mean,
see that's where I don't think I would have. I mean, I still had some complaints about the church word.
Yeah.
But I think if they had said skeptical church, right? I mean, that's why the Kelker one, secular church, right?
Yeah.
Again, not a perfect fit, but it doesn't somehow seem innately self-contradictory. And I think actually they all mean skeptical church, because what they're trying to teach the children, what messages. I mean, atheists don't necessarily have talks about antimatter and the origins of the universe.
Yeah.
You know, that's more like something you get from a cafe inquiry kind of thing, right?
And yeah.
So that seems very much more skeptic. So maybe I'm splitting hairs. It's good to see that there is a much more developed and sense idea that there is a skeptic community that needs to be serviced, because the more that becomes in the air, the more that people become aware, hey, I do have this identity that marks me differently from the majority of the group. We need, you know, I have this attachment, and it'll hopefully grow organically until, of course, you reach the point where we will be the church in the majority, and then we'll just ban everyone from talking.
Yeah, censorship. Well, we're actually kind of running out of time here on Radio Free Thinker.
I have two highlights, one a real highlight, one a sort of heads up. Distinguished Neuroethical Lectures. Scott Kim, an associate professor of psychiatry and the co-director of the Center for Bioethics and Social Science and Medicine at the University of Michigan, We'll be talking about ethics of research with impaired adults who cannot give consent. This is happening on the UBC campus at the Brain Research Center tomorrow at 4 p.m. It's free admission. A very interesting idea. I mean, lots of people who have, you know, severe brain injuries or some diseases that we could help find out more about but can't give consent. A great example recently that we were talking about on the show and has been on the news is about people who have locked-in syndrome or people who are brain dead. Are they really brain dead? And the only way to sort of find out that is to experiment on them. But in experimenting on them, we have denied them the ability to give consent. They cannot give consent, almost by definition. So do we have, is there an ethical debate to be made? Should we use them for that at all? The other highlight I have is just a heads up, is in May is the provincial election. Anyone who votes for a party, I don't want to talk to you. But right now, if you're interested in supporting democracy and becoming a part of the actual machinery of democracy, if you go to Elections BC, they are currently taking names and lists and people to become polling officers, polling supervisors, clerks, the whole nine yards. One, it's a nice way to make some quick cash. But two, it allows you to get into the nitty-gritty of actually what makes a democracy and do your little bit for it.
It is a fun experience if you've never done it before. So check those out. So my skeptical highlights, I got a couple here. So the first one coming up, and this is actually pretty relevant to our conversation, is Cafe Inquiry on March 16th. And the topic is defining religion. So this is taking place Saturday, March 16th, 1 p.m. at SFU Harbor Center. And it's going to be discussing how do we talk about religion? What do we mean when we say the word religion? Because it applies to different things. So we're going to have two perspectives discussed. There's going to be an anthropological discussion about what religion means, followed by a philosophical discussion. So what do we mean philosophically when we say religion, and what do we mean when we talk about religion for cultures and societies and anthropology? So it should be an interesting discussion, and I encourage you to check that out. And then, of course, we also mentioned Vancouver Skeptics in the Pub, which is coming up on March 19th, and this is the one happening in downtown Vancouver. So the Railway Club, a good bastion of free thought and beer. And that is happening at 7:30, March 19th, downtown Vancouver. Always fun. So go check those things out.
Ian, I got breaking news.
Yes.
The Sistine Chapel, the Cardinals, they had their first vote.
Oh.
And do you think they voted for a Pope when the first time out?
I'm going to say no.
Yeah, no, they didn't.
Okay.
So black smoke. Sad.
Yeah, that's unfortunate. Sad. Yeah. Well, I guess, I don't know. I don't really care, actually. So thank you for listening to Radio Free Thinker this week. Thank you to everyone who donated to the fund drive.
Yes, thank you, thank you, thank you.
Really appreciate that. I will hope that you continue to tune in for another year when we do this again. This is Ethan, your free thinking historian, saying thanks for listening.
And this is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
I'm Ryan Beal.
And I'm Kevin Lee.
The ShitHarvardDid.com comedians are coming to your campus. It's like the website, but in real life.
Come see the Sunday Service, who was recently named Canada's Best Improv Group.
Guess what? The show was hosted by Graham Clark of Stop Podcasting Yourself, awarded Canada's Best Podcast.
The comedy will be followed by presentations by Brigitte Depape,
the Senate Rogue Page, and founder of ShitHarvardDid.com, Sean Devlin.
It'll be coming to UBC on March 18th at 6:30 p.m.
Entry by donation at the North Theater.
The event is sponsored by CITR 101.9 FM. And Sean Devlin, founder of ShitHarborDid.com, will personally be doing a push-up for a dollar. If you pay him $100, he'll do 100 push-ups at every event. So come.
Learn.
In my pants.
Laugh.
In my pants.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rose. A morning filled with 400 million suns. The rising of the Milky Way. The cosmos is full.